Today on CyberWork, I talk with Jeff Schmidt of Covail about the lessons that cybersecurity can take from physical security and fire protection. The days of cybersecurity as a pass-fail binary need to go now. That's all today on CyberWork. Also, let's talk about CyberWork Applied, a new series from CyberWork. Whether you want to learn how cross-site scripting attacks work, set up a man-in-the-middle attack, or get a blow-by-blow recap of the Equifax breach, expert InfoSec instructors and industry practitioners will teach you these cybersecurity skills and show you how those skills apply to real-world scenarios. Best of all, it's 100% free. Just go to infosecinstitute.com/learn or check out the link in the description and get started with fun hands-on training that keeps the cybersecurity skills you have relevant. That's infosecinstitute.com/learn. And now, let's begin the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Jeff Schmidt, VP and Chief Cybersecurity Innovator at Covail, is an accomplished cybersecurity expert with a background in security and risk management. He founded JAS Global Advisors LLC, a security consulting firm in Chicago, and Altus, a provider of innovative risk-managed identity service for the financial sector. Jeff is a board member for Delta Risk LLC. In 1998, he worked for the FBI to create the InfraGuard program, receiving commendations from the Attorney General and the Director of the FBI. He's an adjunct professor of system security engineering at the Stevens Institute of Technology and a Zurich Cyber Risk Fellow, Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Jeff received a Bachelor of Science in Computer Information Systems and an MBA from the Fisher College of Business at The Ohio State University. So Jeff came to us with an intriguing topic. He proposes what he calls a detect, defend, and response posture in cybersecurity, and postulates that cybersecurity can learn lessons from the mature sciences of physical security and fire protection. So no matter how you're securing your system now, there's often room for improvement and definitely always room for taking in new ideas. So let's take a closer look. Jeff, thanks for joining me today on CyberWork.
Thanks for having me.
So we always like to start out with the inevitable origin story. How did you first get interested in cybersecurity and computers and tech? Because it looks like your career started in software design engineering, but moved pretty quickly over to security around 2000 and has held fast ever since. So what was it about cybersecurity that you found interesting or compelling?
Yeah, so my origin story is actually relevant to my thoughts on the detect, attend, and respond the thinking. Mm-hmm. So I've always been a computer guy. I was a programmer ever since about third grade, and you know, went to engineering school, and after college, I went to work for Microsoft as a kernel developer. So I was working on NT5, Windows 2000, all of those sorts of things. And then the Melissa and Lovebug mass mailers hit, and that's when my career in security started. I was out of Microsoft when that happened. It was very interesting, Microsoft's kind of internal take on those things. Basically, we were as surprised as everybody else.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, driven by a lack of understanding of how attackers would abuse our systems, and so it got me very interested in understanding the adversary. I think that the defenders, in my case at Microsoft in the mid 90s, the defenders were the developers that, you know, wanted to get their new cool features, you know, into production code. And the attackers were all the people that were trying to abuse the systems that they wrote. Mm-hmm. And the defenders didn't really understand the attackers. They didn't understand, you know, how they viewed their systems, how they would abuse, you know, mistakes that they made and, you know, things like memory management. And so there was an educational component to be taken up there to really train the defenders on how to make their systems more resilient to what attackers actually did. And essentially, that's what I do to this day, is train defenders to better understand how attackers view their systems and how their people, processes, and technology respond.
So, you know, I think like many people who came into cybersecurity in the, you know, the early 2000s, you were there at sort of the ground floor of what is sort of an established practice, but at that point was still being, you know, the rule books were being written sort of for the first time. So can you talk a little bit about some of the stepping stone moments in your career, whether they were large projects or promotions, new skills learned, or other factors that helped you make the jump from this sort of improvised, there's a problem, we have to solve it now, position to the more ambitious projects and sort of fully formed, ideas that you have now? What were some of the main moments in your career in that regard?
Yeah, so, I was always a technologist, grew up coding, went to engineering school and went out to Microsoft as a developer. Again, in the kernel group and the Windows NT group was kind of the nerdiest of the nerdy. And it was over the course of my career there that I realized how important it was for technical people, particularly people in security and risk, to be able to communicate effectively with business people. Mm-hmm. And that was a skill that was very lacking back then and very, very often lacks today. I think that security people very often have a very rigid view. There's a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things. Right. And, security people are grumpy for all sorts of reasons. And I'm a, grumpy security guy. I don't have my suspenders on today, but, we have this feeling that we've been, solving the same problems over and over again, and people don't get it and all of those sorts of things. And that's great to be grumpy like that, but it's not helpful. Mm-hmm. And so effective communication, with non-technical people, with business people, is something that I learned was important, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I think it's really, become something that has helped my career, and it's something that I advise others that I'm mentoring and talking with to, really make sure that you're not just a technologist and you're not just a grumpy security guy or gal, but you're able to communicate, and that's the only way that we're going to improve and we're going to get better.
Yeah, I think there's it's easy to think of the cybersecurity team or the IT department as being this sort of island unto themselves, and they speak their own language and they're sort of contemptuous of everyone else and stuff. But obviously we've heard this in episode after episode that you need to be able to communicate effectively, especially to leadership, but also to just rank and file people who might be making sort of chronic mistakes and might need a gentle nudge rather than, a rude one. So I guess you could right. agree that communication, it's got to be there, especially, as someone who's just entering the industry. You have to know how to do what you do, but also how to convey what you do to others.
Right. And without being the, pick your euphemism, the department of no, the professional parade rainers, mm-hmm. All that, you've got to, find a way to turn it into a risk management discussion. Okay. Not a, you're a bunch of idiots. This is not the way to do it.
Yeah.
My way is the only way to do it.
Sure. We get people from sort of all different levels of the career ladder on here, from CEOs and people starting startups to, people in help desk and stuff. And we always like to ask them what their day-to-day work looks like. So what is your average workday or work week as chief cybersecurity innovator at Covail? Like when do you start? When do the emergencies start piling up? When does your to-do list go up in flames? All the usual
sure.
touch points.
Well, Covail is fantastic because it is a small company. We're about 30 people. And so, when you're in a small company, you get to do everything. And that's one of the things that I really like about working in small companies. And so, there is really no average day for me. I am, working with the board and executives, on business sorts of things, strategy, long-term planning, all of those sorts of activities. And then I'll be on customer calls, working with, my team, problem solving, delivering. All of those things happen in any one day in varying, ratios, obviously. Mm-hmm. My favorite part is, certainly working with clients. Right. I love going through the delivery phases of an engagement where mm-hmm. A client, I have a philosophy, and I tell my team, I want the client to be better that day in working with us. Okay. I don't like security engagements that end in a report that gets dusty and nobody reads.
Yes.
And doesn't lead to improvement. Right. And anybody that's been in the space a long time, gets grumpy about things like that. And so I turn that around. I say, look, I want the client to be better that day. And so my favorite part is when I'm in a meeting, And we're, you know, either doing some sort of a purple team experience or other, you know, debrief, and I can actually watch the client getting better and say, oh, okay, I see how that works. Or we're going to implement a detection there, or we're going to change that piece of code, or, you know, boy, yeah, that cookie really should have been marked secure because I can see how it can be abused. Yep. And so watching clients get better is by far my favorite part of the day.
Are there parts of your job that stress you out on Sunday night as you contemplate your work week?
Yeah, I mean, incidents, you know, and incidents are just code for breaches, right? Sure. The lawyers tell us, you know, you never have a breach, you always have an incident. Sure. Those are always very stressful, and they always happen on Sunday nights, or, you know, the Friday of Thanksgiving weekend, or what have you. It's a lot of stress. You know, most of the time, when you're providing assistance, you know, with an incident, you're providing assistance to people that have never been through anything like this before. Yes. And so there's the, you know, the fear of the unknown. You know, very often people are worried about, you know, things beyond the actual incident in hand. Like, am I going to lose my job over this?
Right.
You know, or when the final analysis comes, you know, am I going to be found at fault, or that I made a mistake, or whatever? I mean, the human side of this, you know, permeates every incident that I've ever worked with. Mm-hmm. And that creates a tremendous amount of stress for all parties involved.
Now, do you sort of think of are you sort of always on call? You mentioned Friday of Thanksgiving weekend or Sunday night. Are you always sort of taking these emergency calls?
Yeah, I mean, I and Covail in general has a very close long-term relationship with our clients. We're not kind of transactional, so it is not unusual for a client to call on a Sunday night and say, hey, Jeff, I think I got a problem. And I always want to be available for that call because I've been on the other end of that, and I know how stressful it can be.
Right. Yeah. And that's good to know, because, you know, as a lot of our listeners are considering what aspects of security they want to, you know, get into. And so if you're interested in doing this kind of work, just be aware that, you know, your clients will have their problems when they have their problems, and you got to be ready to step in and help them out. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're here because of a piece I read of yours entitled Evolving to a Detect, Defend, and Response Posture. In it, you postulate that information security practitioners have much to learn from the mature sciences of physical security and fire protection. So rather than me trying to imperfectly summarize some of your points, I'd like to have you walk through some of these key points yourself. So tell me what you think we can learn by studying the ancient arts of physical security and fire protection, and what about it surprised you?
Sure. So the practice of cybersecurity has been largely a pass-fail exercise for the past 20 years. You know, you are secure and you don't have bad things happen, or you are, you know, not secure and bad things happen. And so the mentality has been, you know, if I do things right, my systems are impervious. And, you know, the corollary to that, if I do things wrong, then, you know, I'm going to get beat up.
Right.
And that is not a healthy position for defenders to take, and for an expectation. The systems have become, you know, too complex and too widespread. And just there's so much going on in general that, you know, you cannot allow the expectation that a system is impervious. You know, the way to have an impervious system is to, you know, shut it off, cut the cord, and bury it in a salt mine someplace.
Sure.
It's not very useful at that point, but it is impervious. And so, you know, I am enlightened by the approaches to fire detection and fire response and physical security, where the approach is not these systems need to be impervious or else they suck. Mm-hmm. It is they need to resist the hazard for a long enough period of time for the cavalry to get there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my background here, the beautiful city of Chicago, you know, we're very sensitive to fires, obviously.
Sure.
And so the fire codes, if you drill into what a fire code in Chicago looks like, particularly in the dense downtown area, it's all time-based. It's based on, you know, your requirements or your building defensibility is based on how far away from the fire station you are. Again, the corollary there being, if you're next door to the fire station, the cavalry will be there quickly. And so the building, you know, may not need to be as defensible for as long. That directly translates into things like armored stairwells and sprinklers and two-way communication. And in the security space, we would call those controls. And so if you're next door to the fire station, you may have fewer controls requirements. Similarly, if you're, 5 miles from the fire station and, bad traffic, and it might take 20 minutes for the cavalry to get there, you have more requirements for the building to be defensible for a longer period of time.
Right.
And so you might need, again, external stairwells and sprinklers and all of those sorts of things. Anybody familiar with the classified world, in the US, you deal with these things called GSA containers, Government Service Administration. GSA containers are where you put classified stuff. And weapons and, other sorts of things that, the government wants to protect. And GSA containers are defined by their time resistance to a particular adversary with a particular set of tools. And so a GSA container is defined as it is resilient to an adversary, an expert adversary with, everything except explosives for 45 minutes. And they talk about surreptitious entry and non-surreptitious entry. And again, all the sorts of things that you care about if you're defending classified material. You want to know that somebody got in, they blew a hole in it, versus somebody was able to enter and exit without you ever detecting it, right? But it's all based on time. The unsaid part of that is there better be an alarm and the cavalry better be there in less than that amount of time.
Yes.
And so that's, again, a really healthy way to view security. Fire safes are the same way. If you go into Home Depot, you'll see a fire rated safe that is rated at a particular temperature for a particular time.
Yep.
So if you're, putting gold in it, you don't really care about the temperature, but you do care about the time. If you're putting paper in it, you definitely care about the temperature and the time. So this whole concept of defending against a hazard for a period of time and the cavalry getting there is a very sophisticated and very healthy way to look at security. And we need to do that in IT and cybersecurity, not assume that we are building impervious systems, but assuming that our systems will be compromised. And that's okay, as long as we detect it and we respond in a reasonable amount of time. Now, unfortunately, as an industry, we really stink at detection.
Right.
And so that's where, we have the first opportunity is to get better at detection. And then we can start to worry about, responding.
Yeah. So what are the deficiencies in the current default model of cybersecurity? Because you note that IBM, Verizon, and CrowdStrike all report that we grant an adversary days, weeks, or even months to operate within our networks before detection. This is curious to me, and I'm wondering what actions or policy changes or just overall changes to cybersecurity posture that you think could or should happen to prevent these enemies within to stay hidden or unreachable for so long. Like, right. I think we all agree that having an enemy in your system for months is a terrible thing. But it's not like anyone saying like, well, there's nothing, like what how does that change exactly?
Yeah. So the most important thing is defenders need to view detection as a scientific exercise.
Okay.
All detection right now, with the exception of some kind of extremely sophisticated players, really all detection nowadays is by luck. And mm-hmm. Anybody that I think most people would agree with that. And if they disagree, we might have a bar conversation about it. But people, the way you detect something is you get lucky. Right.
Right.
Chris had the right instinct at the right time. He looked at the right log.
Yeah.
Chris was on duty.
Something felt off.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But boy, if Chris was on vacation that week and Jeff was on duty and, Jeff's kind of a buffoon, you might not get the detection.
Right.
We're not really, consistent in what logs we detect and what logs we look at on a regular basis and, all of those sorts of things. And so detection, usually occurs either by luck. It occurs when, you get that fateful call from the FBI saying, hey, some of your data showed up in this other thing we're looking at over here. You might want to look at this. By the way, until recently, that's how most detections actually occurred, right. Was by a third party notification. Now, unfortunately, the detection frames are going down. And if you see in the recent, CrowdStrike and Verizon reports, that the time to detect is going down, but if you dig back or dig into it a little bit, it's actually for terrible reasons. The detection windows are not going down because we're getting better at detection. the detection windows are going down because the incidents lately have been self-detecting. They've been ransomware.
Oh, right.
You get the note, you know, you get the horrible little note that says, you know, pay me in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That there's your detection.
Yeah.
Right. And so
from there,
yeah. And so the occurrence lately of these, you know, self-announcing incidents are reducing the detection window, but boy, I mean, it's for terrible reasons. So there's a couple things. I mean, I think people need to really analyze detection. So what are, you know, how do I make this rigorous? How do I make this scientific? How do I make this reliable and predictable? Yes. So that I'm not just depending on, you know, Chris being on duty at the right time and having the right instincts. By the way, you know, frameworks like the NIST CSF, the cybersecurity framework that, you know, look, they split up the world into identify, protect, detect, respond, recover, right? And that's a really healthy, you know, kind of left of boom and right of boom life cycle to look at things. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole, you know, detect stage in the CSF, which is really healthy because now people that organize their thinking, their controls, their budgeting, you know, around CSF, you know, have this, you know, great little block to look at, like, okay, what is our, you know, detection capability? What are our detection objectives?
Right.
And they have to be measured and validated in terms of time. So, you know, I would say that, you know, if I could look into the future or have a hope for the future, a strong, mature, defensive cybersecurity program will have a list of techniques or bad guy, you know, tactics. You can use something like, you know, MITRE ATT&CK or whatever, but that's just a list of techniques that bad guys use.
Yep.
And then a list of controls for each of those techniques that, you know, help, you know, increase your odds of defending and detecting. But then a time to detect and a time to respond objective for each of those. So, you know, you should be able to say by technique, you know, curb roasting, right? Pulling and you know, trying to leverage long live Kerberos tickets, right? In a Windows Active Directory environment. I should be able to detect that in X, 45 minutes or less, 30 minutes or less, 2 hours or less, a day or less. It doesn't, as long as I have the number, it almost doesn't matter.
Right.
As long as I know the number. And then from there, what do I do about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, what aspects of current security practice have to go away and what comes in their place? Like it sounds great. Like we have to start doing this now, but like, what does that actually mean on the ground in terms of changing your current focus, your current tech, your current employee directives or whatever? Like, how does that change?
Yeah. So every aspect of an enterprise security program right now is organized around a pass fail methodology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a control or I don't. I have a green check mark there or I don't. Or, you know, my favorite board slides, you know, the red, yellow, green, right? Those are all effectively pass fail, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we need to change the mentality to a detection and response timeframe.
Okay.
So this bad thing is going to happen to me at some point, right? It's inevitable, right? How do I know what's happening? And how do I detect it in a constant, predictable, reliable timeframe, regardless of who's on duty, regardless of what time of day it is, regardless of whether it's, you know, the Friday of Thanksgiving weekend, or, you know, 2 o'clock on a Tuesday. And then that really, you know, that permeates the whole organization. You know, most enterprises do not have a 24/7 detection and response capability. And so then you have to look at, well, do I use, you know, other providers, MSPs, are there aspects of this that I need to outsource? Or, you know, does my business dictate that I do need to have a 24/7 capability natively? So, I mean, those are the sorts of questions that we need to evolve to and we need to get to. And those are great, you know, resourcing questions for the executives and for the board. If your requirements say you need a 24/7 capability, there's obviously, you know, budget associated with that and right. other, you know, interesting discussions to have.
Yeah, that leads to my next question. So how big of a change do you think this is in terms of implementation, budget, timeframe? Certainly C-suites are and boards are famously reticent at making huge changes and spending huge amounts of money for, you know, all of a sudden there's a problem when there wasn't a problem before and so forth. So what is the scope of this look like to you for, you know, I know obviously every system is different, but what do you think?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I think it's enlightening and liberating. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is, look, in the security space, I mean, it's full of noise, it's full of vendors, and nobody really knows what to do, right? Everybody has a philosophical and a religious position. And I'm full of, you know, I'm just like any other, you know, security guy or gal, I'm full of philosophical and religious positions, right. You know, but nobody really knows what to do, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's all kind of, you know, non-scientific. And you know, should I use, you know, should I deploy a cloud proxy or should I deploy an endpoint tool? Mm-hmm. I don't know, right? I mean, I could make it, they're both fine security controls, right. You know, you can make an argument either way, but you know, what should I do? I don't know. What's everybody else doing? You know?
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I was with a very well-known security luminary at RSA 3 or 4 years ago, and we were standing on the floor in one of the two-story booths that vendors have, you know, kind of looking around the floor. And if you've ever been to RSA, you know, it's just this massive sea of humanity.
Yes.
You know, there's tens of thousands of vendors, and this gentleman looked around the floor, you know, kind of pensively like an old grumpy security guy does, and said, "And this is why we have a problem." Mm. You know, it's very confusing. Nobody knows what to do. And yeah. So I think, you know, if you can organize around something like I need to defend by having constant time detections and response for a list of MITRE attack techniques that are applicable to my enterprise and my vertical, that becomes very specific and very actionable. Like that's something that I can do. That helps me, you know, do I need a cloud proxy for my remote employees or do I need an EDR? You know, well, absent some rubric like that, it's an impossible decision to make. But if I'm looking at like, okay, here's, you know, MITRE attack and here's how I detect and defend and respond against every technique, here's my gap, right? I have no way to detect in constant time when, you know, Mabel clicks on something bad, because Mabel's always going to click on something bad. There's nothing we can do about it. Oh, and Mabel's computer is at home, off the VPN, connected to the internet directly, and I'm not getting logs, right? I have no way to detect that, okay? Now I can start digging through, okay, well, what tools can help me with that, right? Because that's a gap. So I think it's a very healthy way to think about organizing an overall security program. And I hope that, you know, we advance that level of maturity.
So let's pivot over from there. That, you know, this is the point where we start giving additional value to our newcomer listeners who are trying to put their first foot into the cybersecurity industry. So I think if you are able to come to a new company with these kinds of recommendations and say, you know, we want to move towards, you know, constant real-time detection, you know, that's customized to your specific platform and so forth. Like, what are some cybersecurity skills that students or novice professionals should be learning and studying to stay ahead of the curve and be able to sort of deliver this to whatever new company that they're starting with?
Yeah, so a couple things. I mean, first of all, and I mentioned it earlier, you know, enough business knowledge and acumen to be able to communicate effectively is critical. Right. And so, you know, to the extent that you can, you know, use online training and, you know, as you advance in your career, you know, getting a business certificate or an MBA or something like that to balance a technical background, I think is a really good long-term, you know, this is a long-term business risk management business that we're in, and it's not going away.
Right.
You know, security guys and gals are chronically employable, as a friend of mine once said. And so the ability to integrate with the business and talk about risk is really important. Additionally, you know, for the last 10 years or so, you know, we have largely been throwing people in tools and then, you know, by corollary money at the security problems. And, you know, obviously we can't continue to scale like that. Right. And so, you know, investing in, and well, from a people perspective, understanding automation technologies, understanding, I have to do air quotes around AI, ML, right. You know, but I'm not saying that in the snake oil sense. I mean, there's real valuable things there.
Yes.
That will help us do our jobs and will help focus the humans. You know, AI, machine learning, all that will never replace the humans. I tell the story. It's like, you know, the National Weather Service, you know, they all have models, but then there's some meteorologist that looks at the models and says,
right,
here's what I think is going to happen. Right. That's the way we're going to get into being in security.
Yeah. There's no robot Thomas Skilling, to use another Chicago record.
Right. So understanding what the, AI and ML technologies are actually doing, where they're helpful, how to interpret the results, how to use them to lever up, or again, I have to, force multiplier, mm-hmm. All these air quotes things, to really help your organization scale, right. is a really important skill set to have. Thirdly, defenders need to understand attackers. We are, we're minting security guys and gals as fast as we can, because everybody understands the, security skills shortage and, yes. All of that sort of thing. And that's wonderful. And, I'm happy to see, new folks entering the space, but very often the new folks entering the space, are your first line defenders. Mm-hmm. Very often, your newly minted guys and gals come in and help desk and SOC roles and things like that, they're the level one defenders. And those are the people that have the lightest and the least developed instincts about, yes. What's actually happening, what a bad guy is actually doing. I've shown, newly minted security guys and gals attacker tools like, Mimikatz and Bloodhound and things like that, and they think it's magic. It's just a lack of familiarity. And so I would say every defender, hang out with offensive testers. Pen testers, offensive testers.
That's great.
It's they're an interesting bunch. But as a defender, you have to understand attackers, have to understand how they think, how right. they view a system, what they do, how the spy versus spy or counterpunch is going to work.
Yep.
And that makes you a better defender.
Yeah, be comfortable with a wide range of tools and how to sort of use them creatively and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So for people who are looking to get into cybersecurity from other professions, or people who feel stuck in their current job, do you have any strategy tips you can recommend to help them get unstuck? What's one thing you could recommend someone to do tonight that would help them get closer to doing this kind of work?
Yeah. So there is a tremendous amount of cybersecurity content online. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the paid courses and the kind of the traditional, repositories of knowledge. The paid courses are great. And I'm, but this podcast, there's all of the cybersecurity luminaries out there, most of them, write blogs, are present on Twitter, are present on LinkedIn, on podcasts, are sharing their craft. I mean, that is one wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing about the cybersecurity space. Even though it can seem impenetrable and, be populated by a bunch of grumpy people, really the amount of sharing and openness of the cybersecurity community is tremendous.
Yeah.
I would suggest to anybody, follow people, read, watch the videos and the podcasts, yep. find a core list of, 10 or 15 folks that, are really interesting in your particular area. The cybersecurity area has, 101 niches. It can seem daunting to somebody, just kind of getting into the space, but, there are a lot of niches that are interesting. Everything from, secure coding, web apps, yep. That's a whole practice right there. Governance and controls and, kind of defense optimization, that's a whole area. Offensive testing is a fantastic area. Identity and authentication and authorization systems, that's an area that I have a particular, interest and passion about. I mean, that's a fantastic area, and it's the root of almost every security problem. I mean, almost every security yeah. problem started as an authentication and authorization problem. So pick some niches, that kind of interest you, pick some personalities to follow and immerse yourself.
That's great. So as we wrap up today, do you have any final words for the industry, things that you'd like to see start to change on a wide scale? Because obviously some people are going to implement this, some people aren't, but what are your crystal ball, you know, predictions and hopes for the coming years?
Yeah, I really think, you know, we are entering a golden age of defense.
Okay.
I think that the industry is evolving from a, you know, I've got to be impervious to, no, you know what, I need to detect, defend, respond, you know, in a loop, in a cycle, and OODA loop to use the term, where my defenses are always evolving based on what the attackers are doing.
Right.
And that, you know, static reports that, you know, collect dust in a corner, you know, compliance reports that, you know, are you know, checkbox sorts of exercises, they're not going to do it anymore. And so, you know, that's going to mean evolving to, you know, more frequent and more dynamic offensive testing, not the, you know, kind of offensive testing that we've been used to in the past, but more, you know, purple team, which is the red team and the blue team working together, mm-hmm. to make the defenses better. Instead right. of doing one or two offensive exercises over the course of a year, you might do five or six
yeah.
offensive exercises over the course of a year. Integrating offensive exercises, which are largely technical, with the non-technical components of defend and respond. So, you know, something bad happens. Mabel clicks on something bad. The attacker, you know, has access to Mabel's machine and starts moving laterally. Great. There's the technical piece of that response, but then there's the non-technical piece as well, mm-hmm. right? What sorts of compliance and contractual requirements did this indicate? How are we going to communicate, you know, with our employees? If we're going to require 30,000 employees to do a password reset, right? What are we going to, you know, message to them? What are we going to message when that becomes public? What are we going to message when we get, you know, hauled up in front of Congress to testify about the particular incident that occurred, right? So continuing the technical exercises into the non-technical realm with things like tabletops and other things, I think are incredibly important to really integrate the detect and respond pieces into a more holistic response. I think it's a really, really exciting time to be in defense. And I think that as, you know, businesses build a defense capability that they can do all of these things, it's a great time to be in the space.
This has been a great talk, and I want to thank you for your time today, Jeff. But before we go, tell us about Covail. What are some services you provide and some project services or initiatives that you're working on for 2021 that you're particularly excited about and you want to tell our listeners about?
Absolutely. So as you might imagine, I have a passion for offensive testing. Mm-hmm. And so Covail offers a number of offensive testing services that span the range from very traditional compliance-oriented pen tests all the way through purple team, constant loop, supported by tabletop, kind of very advanced offensive form factors.
Right.
We do those for a number of large enterprises and a number of verticals. We also integrate a compliance and governance team into those exercises. So, you know, I like to say if you're concerned about ransomware, for example, all, you know, 800 controls in, you know, NIST, you know, 853 or 800-171 don't matter equally.
Yeah.
There's like, you know, do 12 well.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
So we focus on helping
your system. Yeah.
Right. Right. So we identify and help you figure out which controls, you know, really matter, are really going to contribute to your security.
Got it.
And really support the objectives of the offensive team.
All right. One last question for all the marbles. If our listeners want to learn more about Jeff Schmidt or Covail, where can they go online?
Yeah. So I would go to covail.com, and we have a blog there. We have information about our services there. A lot of the philosophy and the points that you've seen here are covered in the content you'll find there. So please visit us at covail.com.
Terrific. Jeff, thank you so much for your time and insights today.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure.
And as always, thank you all to at home or at work for listening and watching today. New episodes of the CyberWork podcast are available every Monday at 1 p.m. Central, both on video at our YouTube page and at infosecinstitute.com/podcast or on audio wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. And don't forget about our hands-on training series, CyberWork Applied. Tune in as expert InfoSec instructors teach you a new cybersecurity skill and show you how that skill applies to real-world scenarios. Go to infosecinstitute.com/learn to stay up to date on all things CyberWork. Thank you once again to Jeff Schmidt, and thank you all for watching and listening. We'll speak to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to infosecinstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to infosecinstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.